This week's Star Trek Discovery recap is sponsored by TrueCar. You know, there's something about TrueCar a lot of people don't know. Using TrueCar can help you buy a used car. In fact, there's over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. And if you're looking to buy new or used, you can get upfront pricing information that empowers discounts off the list price for used cars and a better buying experience through our TrueCar certified dealer network. Choose your pain? Yeah, it's called not going through TrueCar to buy a newer used car. You can get to see what other people paid for the car that you want so you know what a fair price is and feel confident when you're using TrueCar. And with TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing so you can enjoy a quick and easy buying experience. With TrueCar, you'll easily find the new or used car that you want. Best of all, TrueCar users have an average savings of over $3,000 off of MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. Star Trek Discovery Episode 5. Choose Your Pain is over, but we're just getting started here on the Star Trek Discovery post-show recap. And now, here are the two guys who are only powered by cruelty-free tardigrades. I am Rob Cisterno here today with Jim Gibbons. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing very, very well, Rob. I've just played a great office prank on Harry Mudd by freeze putting his stapler in some Jell-O mold. So I'm ready to talk Star Trek.
Right. Did you set up some sort of like a mirror where then when he points the finger to choose his pain, it points right back at him?
Yeah, that's the ultimate office prank.
And then Harry Mudd in the mirror walks the other direction. Is that what happens?
Yeah, and it's chilling. And then you're like, I really should rethink my pranks. They're maybe going to cause some actual pain for Mr. Mudd.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a lot to get to, of course. Jim, thank you very much for joining us. For loyal post-show recaps listeners, you have heard Jim before on the Defenders podcast that he's done with Josh Wigler. Jim is also a comic book editor, so he knows a lot about all sorts of nerdy stuff in terms of Star Trek and comics. And I'm very excited to have you here to talk some Discovery and podcasts with me for the first time.
Yeah, I'm excited to do it. I'm a big Star Trek fan, and I think in comparison for people who found me a little negative on the Defenders podcast, I've been really overall pretty high on Discovery and have really enjoyed it. Now I'm biased as a Trek fan, but I think I'm also in the rare realm of Star Trek fan where I never watched any Star Trek while it was actually airing. So this is the first Star Trek series for me that I've watched live as it's happening. And so I'm kind of thrilled all the time about it.
Well, give us your backstory. What's your favorite Star Trek?
My favorite Star Trek is definitely Deep Space Nine. I'm in the middle of a Deep Space Nine rewatch right now, which of all the series is probably the most in common with Discovery so far. And just like that, there are actual wars and there's a lot of politics and there's a lot of, you know, episode by episode serialization. But yeah, I think, you know, when I was a kid, I was very much a Star Wars fan. And then whatever year it was that First Contact came out, something about the preview for it really caught my eye. And that was like my family birthday thing. I was like, we're going to go see Star Trek. And my whole family is not a Star Trek family, so they're very confused by that. But yeah, after that, you know, in college, you know, watched a lot of Next Generation and some Voyager when it was like serialized during the free periods I had between classes. And then when they all hit Netflix, I kind of dove in and started doing my front to back watches of a lot of the series that I'd only seen in bits and pieces here and there.
Okay, well, we're going to get into episode number 5, and you and I were talking really briefly before we came on. We were both very bullish about this episode of Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, I mean, Rob, you have to be thrilled because we open the episode with what has been teased for 3 episodes now, Tilly finally snored.
Yes, yes. We got to see Tilly snoring. We got to hear F-bombs. We finally got to see Rainn Wilson appear on the show. So there was a lot to work through here. And again, one of my complaints early on was that I felt like that we did not get a lot of sort of self-contained stories in. Like, it was just overly serialized, I felt like. But again, again, this is like the second or third week in a row where we sort of like have its own self-contained story with like a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah, I think if Discovery kind of ends up in this cadence where, you know, each episode introduces a concept that is followed up in the next episode and yet still has some of that more traditional episodic stuff, it could definitely be, you know, very much within the realm of traditional Trek while also boldly going where no new Trek show has gone before.
Before we get into the episode, let me just quickly mention our feed for Star Trek Discovery. You could subscribe to the podcast, and we always appreciate when you leave us your feedback and your star ratings at postshowrecaps.com/Star Trek. Okay, so this episode ends up beginning with Michael Burnham dreaming about the tardigrade that almost akin to Elliot and E.T. She seems almost to have this connection with the tardigrade.
Yeah, I think she's realizing the tardigrade really wants to phone home.
Yeah.
It is not enjoying its job as a navigator of the spore drive.
Right. And it was almost like a metaphorical connection where she had said last week to Saru that, oh, he's not a bad person. He just was stressed out and did a bad thing one time. You can't really hold it against the water bear. Don't hold it against Ripper. But it did seem as though they were almost like psychologically linked.
Yeah, I think it was in the last podcast. Maybe John Cross was saying that she's projecting
yes.
on the tardigrade, which I think Tilly actually says in their little lunchroom conversation, she's like, oh, like you're feeling feelings. And because of those feelings, you're actually connecting with this animal that you did not expect to. And Michael Burnham, you know, after her upbringing on Vulcan, is a little shocked that she's so emotionally connected to this creature.
Yeah.
I think.
Tilly says to her in that conversation, yeah, it's because you don't have that much to do. You're thinking too much about your relationship working with the tardigrade that she's like, I don't like this. I don't want to keep doing this.
Yeah, these blasted emotions always getting in the way.
Yeah, that Burnham and Tilly, that they have such an interesting relationship where they end up their roommates, but then they also, you know, Tilly wants to have lunch with Michael Burnham, and she really wants to bond with her. She's so relieved to hear from Michael Burnham that, no, the problem isn't actually with Tilly. It's that Tilly is like a George Costanza. She knows that, don't do it's not you, it's me. That's my move.
Yeah, I feel like any other human that was not as kind of self-conscious as Tilly would have quickly realized that, yes, Michael Burnham is the problem in this relationship. She's very up in her own head. But I think it's interesting seeing these two characters interact. I have kind of like a bit of a working theory on like how the character of Michael Burnham came together. And it's that she's a little bit of instead of taking one person, kind of like Gene Roddenberry did in making Kirk and Spock and McCoy essentially the three parts of one person so they can talk everything out. You know, you've got your courageous captain and your intelligent, you know, logical Vulcan, and then the humanism of McCoy. I think they've kind of thrown all those pieces together in Michael Burnham. And so they've added characters around her like Tilly who are even more emotional and even more in tune, that they have to kind of pull these tiny moments where you see Burnham, you know, smile or something when the tardigrade is freed. They have Tilly around to pull those out and Saru around to pull out the more logical moments and stuff like that, which I think is kind of a interesting thing for a lead in what's usually like a very complimentary bunch of relationships on the show. You have a lot of people pulling out who she is instead of her complimenting, you know, the cast in a similar way as Kirk and Spock and McCoy did.
And one of the things I think that's really interesting with this cast, and I feel like that we see it week after week, is that unlike other Star Trek casts, that this cast or this crew has a lot of flaws between Lorca, between even Saru, and where it's like, in the past, you know, you had characters that were like trying to sort of like work things out maybe a little bit more, or maybe they had like where Geordi was blind but had a visor and Data, you know, wasn't human but wanted to become one, and Worf tried to understand his surroundings. Like these characters that are on the Discovery do seem like that they have like major character flaws.
Yeah, and that actually is an interesting thing because, and this is almost my second kind of working theory about the show, is that when you get into Next Generation in that era of Star Trek, you kind of have a level of behavior and intelligence that you kind of assume all Starfleet officers will perform their duties with. You know, they're going to have their kind of smaller flaws, and they're going to have to figure out things about themselves. But generally, they're all going to be pretty by the book Starfleet people. When you look at the original series, Starfleet is not as kind of established, and there's not as many rules at first. So you see, you know, this crew of the Enterprise essentially being the first people to solve a lot of these like complex Star Trek problems. And I think what we see here is we're in a pre-Kirk and a pre-Spock Starfleet. And so any lesson they kind of learned is not like something that anyone could have learned beforehand. Otherwise, original series episodes would be like, oh, we checked the logs and on the Discovery they did this, so we'll just do this. And I think it leads to the ability to have a lot more flawed characters in kind of a very different Starfleet, a Starfleet that has not learned all the lessons of that, you know, kind of historic Enterprise crew. And so it's great. I think it allows, for me, that's kind of my fan correction, if you will. Like, it allows me to go, oh, it makes sense that certain things on this don't feel like Star Trek, because a lot of Star Trek stuff hasn't happened yet. So how could they know that yet? And I think you get a lot of flawed characters in that, which is, you know, a bit more compelling for what modern TV audiences want than the very aspirational Starfleet that we kind of are familiar with.
So in this episode, we end up seeing this sort of like meeting. I guess this is aboard a starbase where Lorca is being told they want him to scale back the number of leaps that Discovery is making because they don't want the Klingons to know how big of a secret weapon Discovery has turned into. They've been very busy since the last episode.
Yeah, did you find this a little confusing, Rob? Because at the end of the last episode, Lorca makes such a big deal about, like, waiting to the last moment to defeat the Klingons with his spore drive, essentially, only to find that they don't really know about it and they're not really supposed to know about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I guess that they have conducted a number of other missions where they're just sort of, I guess, blowing everything up before they can realize that it's Discovery, and they know that the Federation did something, but nobody might be clear about that. It's actually Lorca who was pulling off all these, you know, major shifts in the battle.
Yeah, I at the end of episode 4, I was like, oh, he's like, because Lorca is so war oriented and he's such a military man, I was like, oh, he's going for some shock and awe, he's trying to scare the Klingons. And then you find out that he didn't really reveal the drive to them, and then no one knows. I thought that was a little confusing. I mean, overall, I've been very on board with this show, but there's been a few moments like that where I'm like, I'm not sure that tracks with what we saw.
No, I was a little confused during this whole part because I didn't realize that they were on a starbase. And then when Lorca was coming back in the shuttlecraft, I'm like, where was he? And I guess I'm just assuming that that he must have gone off to go have this like meeting.
Yeah, that was a little, it took me a second on that one too. I think I was a little distracted. This is such an odd thing, but I finally put together that on the costumes, the more stripes, the more like little pinstripes they have on their shoulder indicates ranks.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
The Admiral has those little stripes. Like, it's not just on like the shoulder. It's like halfway down her arm. And I was like, oh, what's going on? Why is this costume so distracting to me? And I was like, oh, that's a subtle costuming thing. I did not pick that up earlier.
It's, you know, they need like a Garrick on board the Discovery to sort of like, if anybody gets promoted, to just be sewing in more stripes.
Yeah, I think you need a good tailor to kind of reel it in, because you guys talked about this a little in the past, but there's like a lot of different Starfleet insignia going on. And now we've got more stripes, and, you know, overall, I think the costumes look pretty slick for Starfleet, but there's definitely these things where I'm like, you know, at the end, not to jump too far ahead, but you see Stamets in his pajamas, and I was like, all right, his pajamas has a Starfleet insignia on it?
Yeah, well, that's very funny sense at the end of the episode that we got to see the Starfleet pajamas. You have to wear Starfleet pajamas?
I don't know. I mean, maybe if he's a sleepwalker, you know what I mean? He ends up, you know, teleporting somewhere. They'll be like, oh, Stamets teleported into sleep again. Contact the Discovery.
You would think that somebody would have sort of like, you know, property of Starfleet Academy shirts and stuff like that. But maybe they're just so comfortable, the Starfleet pajamas.
Yeah, I can't imagine those just like constantly itching you right on your like left pectoral muscle.
Right. Like if you're a stomach sleeper, like I can't imagine that the Starfleet pajamas are, you know, ideal.
That's how evolved they are in the future. Everyone's a back sleeper.
Yeah.
No one stomach sleeps anymore.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that we don't know exactly how they sleep, but we've seen people in different Star Trek series sleeping in a regular bed. It doesn't look like they're like hovering or anything like that.
Yeah, but there aren't they often like, as I recall, they're often sleeping on like pallets with like barely a pillow and no blankets. Mm-hmm. So the sleep of the future must be very strange.
So we spent a lot of time on the light sensitivity of Captain Lorca. He doesn't want to get his eyes fixed. Are you buying this as something that a 23rd century person is dealing with?
That's one of the things that I thought was most interesting about this episode, and I can't tell if it's like really kind of subtle, clever characterization of Lorca, or if it's kind of some sloppy storytelling. Because when we get farther down the line, right, there's the reveal that he has sacrificed a whole ship of Starfleet people to somehow save himself. It's a little vague, mm-hmm. but looking at the explosion of the ship he detonated is why his eyes don't work right. And that's like the pain he wants to carry with him, you know. And I like that. I think that's kind of a cool thing of like, all right, he cares. He did this thing. He made this mistake. And so that's why he wants to keep this injury. But at the same point, the Lorca we kind of are getting to know in this episode does not really strike me as a guy who thinks twice about anything other than war being his main passion and winning the war.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a very compassionate guy when all said and done.
But maybe he wasn't always that way.
Well, and that's what I'm trying to figure out on this episode. And we'll just, you know, time will tell. Are they showing us that he kind of fakes compassion well because he's so committed to being part of this war, and maybe he saved himself because he knew his destiny was to fight the Klingons more? Or is he actually a guy who was less compassionate and has become more compassionate? Or is the fact that he made this huge mistake why he is so driven? And I'll be curious to see, because he's kind of he's a bit nebulous. Is he a villain? Is he an anti-hero? Is he a misunderstood hero? I'm very curious to see where Lorca goes through the series.
Well, do you feel like that he views it as a mistake because of that? The way he described it was that he ended up saving the entire crew from some sort of a torture back on the Klingon homeworld, Kronos.
Yeah, and that's exactly... You know, I forget, someone was telling me at a book once, and they were telling me that the interesting thing about it is a lot of times, maybe it was Gone Girl or something like that, but a lot of times when you have a character telling you what they've gone through, you presume that there's truth in that because it's TV or it's a novel, and people tell you what they're thinking because otherwise, how could you know? And with Lorca here, I can't tell if he believes that, or that's just what he's telling people. And I think there's something interesting there where it's like we have to kind of puzzle out what his motivations might be. And I don't know what they are yet. I think that's going to be one of the big things they kind of hold to the end of this show.
Okay, so we end up with Lorca ending up being taken prisoner by the Klingons. They're up to something that they know Lorca is responsible for pulling off this mission, and they want to end up taking him prisoner. They're able to pin down his location, and then they take him captive and pour one out for the shuttle pilot.
Always, always. There's no shuttle pilot who makes it through this show.
Yeah.
Shuttle pilots are the new red shirts, I think.
It's not good for the shuttle pilots. And, you know, very sad news that Captain Lorca also dropped his eye pen.
Yeah, I have a peanut allergy, so I carry around an EpiPen.
Yes.
And his eye pen looks exactly like that. I'm like, oh, no, don't feed Lorca any peanuts. He's going to be in trouble.
That would have been the pain the Klingons administered to him.
Yeah, they just give him a PB&J. And he's like, oh, no. But I have to wonder, did you like, this is another thing I wonder about this episode. And with the serialized nature, I kind of presume we'll get an answer to it next episode. But the Klingons seem to find Lorca pretty easily.
Yeah.
And I wondered about that. It made me very curious. Did you have any thoughts about that?
What do you think, that there's a mole?
I found myself, you know, when we eventually meet in the prison with Lorca, Lieutenant Tyler, I found myself very suspicious of him, and I wonder if there is a mole.
Okay, well, that's actually very interesting, because I was interested to know if he's going to then go on to become some sort of regular part of the Discovery crew.
I think he probably will, and I think it's good. I actually like one of the things I like most about this episode as a whole is I felt like we really started to actually have a crew, as opposed to a few characters that were kind of plot specific. You know, we really got some good time with Dr. Culber in this episode, and it started to feel like and even Saru talking to the bridge crew, you really started to feel like these people are not just potentially expendable extras like our security chief in the last episode. Mm-hmm.
Right. There's a couple people that, you know, I've seen them a number of times, but we haven't really fleshed out who they are. But yeah, I would like to like really get to know some of the other members of the crew. And we definitely got that at least here with the doctor in this episode, that he became more of a three-dimensional character. But mm-hmm. I think that there's still more work to be done.
Yeah. And I think it's probably I like that they're not rushing it too much. I mean, I think it works with the way they're doing the show, and it kind of leaves you with a little bit more of like, oh, when are we going to meet the rest of the crew? Is Tyler going to be a new part of the crew, or is he a mole that's going to have like a couple episode arc where we find out more about the Klingon plot or something like that?
Okay, so at this point, this is where Saru ends up being updated about the status of the captain, and now he is the acting captain of the Discovery. And this was a big episode for Saru, because he's now thrust into this position of taking the lead, and it is against his nature.
It is. And I think that's interesting. And you guys have discussed this a little bit, like the way they set up Saru is he's from a race of people that is essentially cowardly for the sake of survival. And I think it's a fun counterpoint to Klingons, at least as we've seen in the past. And I think Klingons here, which are traditionally like an aggressive, warlike race. And you've seen how they've had to like kind of with Worf, you know, conform to Starfleet. And I like that Saru is kind of the opposite. He's essentially like a self-preservation driven creature who now has to conform to the, like, he's an introvert having to be an extrovert because of Starfleet and because of his position now. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. And I liked that he's trying to ask the computer about what are the traits of the greatest Starfleet captains, living and deceased. Now, we saw Captain Georgiou on the list. We saw Captain Pike on the list. Were any of the other names familiar to you?
Yeah, Jonathan Archer is Scott Bakula from Enterprise.
Oh, okay. So we have some Enterprise canon.
Yeah, but I did not recognize the other names. They, you know, they might be, you know, subtle nods or something like that. I didn't recognize the other names, but I got to imagine somewhere in the writer's room when they came up with this plot device, they're like, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to show a list of names of other characters on the computer. People are going to go nuts.
Yeah, I didn't really understand what Saru was asking the computer to do. To like, was he asking to go through like the crew's logs to sort of like ask how he was being described?
You know, I don't know about that. I thought it was kind of interesting that it seemed like he was asking the computer to do something that I feel like is much more of a modern technology thing, like some AI and machine learning, where he was like, computer, run algorithms to compare my time as captain to these other captains and give me an analysis. I feel like the computer, as it was envisioned, you know, in the 90s, in like Next Generation and stuff, they did stuff that now we see is a little bit closer to what technology is, but nowhere near as far as I think they ever expected technology to come in the next 15 years from when they were doing, you know, Next Generation. And so I like this. I thought this was like, oh, this is kind of like a modern science idea of data-driven analysis of, you know, it's leadership, essentially. So
yeah.
I think that's all he was doing. I don't think he was doing anything untoward. I think he's just really underscoring his logical nature of like, you know, I'm worried about my performance, so I want you to compare my performance to the greats and tell me how bad I did or how good.
Michael Burnham and Saru have had a very contentious relationship, certainly since even from before she was on the Discovery, and that she ends up coming to talk to him on the bridge about the tardigrade. He is not hearing anything of it.
No, I like that they brought this to a head a little bit. I mean, there's been a lot of passive aggressive Burnham and Saru scenes. And I like that here, you know, Saru is in command all of a sudden, and he can't be passive about his feelings on Burnham anymore. He has to put her in her place. And at the same time, Burnham is interesting, because I think the characterization of Burnham so far is if there is authority, she will buck against it. Mm-hmm. She's done it once now, and she's got a taste for it, I guess, because, you know, either that or her feeling of Saru is just, you know, this guy should be my first officer. I should not be reporting to him.
Yeah. And he doesn't want to hear anything else about the tardigrade.
No, he's really done with the tardigrade. He's just like, make it jump. And let's use that. Let's go.
The tardigrade is depressed, I think.
The tardigrade is. Yeah. I think this is interesting. This is like such a nerdy little nitpick. But there's the scene where Burnham is talking to Dr. Culber, and she's like, it cries out in pain, which I thought was a little bit of a goofy thing from the last episode, because I'm like, would a tardigrade cry? Can a tardigrade even speak? And Culber is like concerned, and Burnham's like, oh, you think I'm anthropomorphizing this creature? And I'm like, well, you're not thinking she did. I think the special effects department on Star Trek did. but overall, I mean, I think the stuff with Saru and Burnham in this episode is really good. I think it kind of needed to happen. And I think a lot of stuff that we saw in this episode was really going from the initial kind of chaos of the pilot and starting to put together the crew and their relationships and moving them into kind of the what will likely probably be the status quo of the Starship Discovery over the long haul of the series. And I think they made a lot of ground in this episode. And you've liked Saru a lot. Like, did you enjoy the Saru stuff in this episode?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they, you know, are a little on the nose with the threat ganglia and its emergence at certain points, that he's almost like, a dog that can't help but, you know, when its tail is wagging, and then it's like a real tell for him in these certain situations. But I know I did like him in this episode.
Yeah, I feel like dating for Saru must be very difficult.
Yes.
he's got an obvious tell no matter what's going on.
He'd wear like some sort of like a hood.
Yeah, like all the Ferengis have those weird little like aprons pinned to the back of their skull. Mm-hmm. He should just get one of those.
Yeah.
Keep it, you know, he'd be a terrible poker player, I think, is the problem. He needs like a hat.
Yeah. Don't invite him to date his poker game with Stephen Hawking anytime soon.
No, he will get cleaned out.
Okay. So I think we can talk about what goes on the Klingon ship as sort of its own self-contained thing without cutting back and forth to what's going on at Discovery. So we end up sort of getting introduced to Rainn Wilson as Harry Mudd. And I thought that he was a lot of fun in this episode.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's, you know, Harry Mudd at the end of the day in the original series is just kind of a goofball, even though he's essentially like a pimp selling women. Like he's played as like a fun villain. But I thought Rainn Wilson, like, I was excited when I heard he was cast. And I have to say, after this episode, much as I liked it, it felt like he was kind of shoehorned in here. And so I believe I had read at some point he's going to be in multiple episodes as Harry Mudd. And so I think that's good, because this is definitely like a character introduction, and it didn't really need to happen here, other than I presume they have big plans for Harry Mudd ahead. And I'm excited to see them, because I thought Rainn Wilson did great.
Right. And if you hadn't read that he's going to make multiple appearances, him screaming in his last scene, you haven't seen right. The last of me. I think that it was telegraphed a little bit here.
Yeah. I mean, either that or it's a heck of a red herring.
Yeah,
he's like actually referring to the Starship Enterprise episode. You know, he's like the original series. He's like, you'll see me again.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, I may look different and I may be older, but you will see my character again.
Yeah. I mean, I really hope, you know, I think the curious thing about everything that happens in the Klingon prison is Tyler definitely struck me as suspicious. But obviously, Rainn Wilson, you know, or Harry Mudd, we see is collaborating with the Klingons for his own self-preservation. And I've got to presume that that's somehow going to be how it comes back around. They're united by their desire for revenge against Lorca.
So in the beginning of the scene in the prison, when we have the first time the Klingons come in and introduce this idea of choose your pain, and Harry Mudd says, oh, that guy over there, he's what I like to call out to lunch. Was that Tyler or that was a different guy?
I think that was a different guy. I think it has to be a different guy, because I'm pretty sure they killed him. though Tyler seemed very familiar with their finishing move when they did it. So it was a little, I think this is one of the things that Discovery hasn't quite as a show locked down yet, is they do certain things so quickly that they're a little confusing. Like the Starbase thing earlier in the episode, you know, all we needed was like a little, you know, caption at the bottom to say, you know, Starbase, whatever, you know, Admirals meeting. We didn't get that. So it's like, wait, where was Lorca? Why is he in a ship now or a shuttle boat now? And I think this is kind of the same thing there, where they kind of move so quickly sometimes. And the show is, you know, so shadowy compared to any other Star Trek series that, you know, some of the stuff is a little confusing. But I'm pretty sure that was a different guy. And Tyler had been hiding somewhere, or presumably was
with the Klingon captain.
Yeah, with the Klingon captain.
Yeah.
Getting freaky.
So, what did you think about the choose your pain premise? Did you feel like that worked for the Klingons?
I feel like, you know, you guys have talked a lot about the Klingons on this podcast, and I think every critique of the Klingons in Discovery so far has been totally spot on. And fine. I don't really understand what they're doing with the Klingons here, other than if I go back to my theory where I'm fan correcting, right? Like the Klingons become so interesting when you get into late Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. They become so much more fleshed out as a race. And I've got to presume they're like, well, we're going back before all that. So they have to be, I guess, a little bit more angry and tribal and just aggression driven, and they just feel like pure villains. They don't feel like they have any of the nuance that Klingons could potentially have. And so Choose Your Pain, you know, it was fine, but it felt a little bit uncreative to me.
The idea of Choose Your Pain, and it worked fine in the episode to me, but just as a philosophy, it almost seems like something that maybe the Romulans or the Cardassians would come up with. It just does not seem like an honorable thing that the Klingons would be working on.
Yeah, I agree. It feels a little psychological for Klingons, but especially for the Discovery era Klingons.
Mm-hmm. Like, I get it. The Klingons might want to come in and like, okay, now prisoners, now you guys fight, and whoever is the, you know, toughest fighter gets to stay on board. But to get the ability to dole out punishment, I don't think that the Klingons would look at that as a honorable thing of like, oh, you can hand off your beating to somebody else.
No, I agree. And I do think as well, like the idea of like tying someone down and torturing them also doesn't necessarily seem
right.
Super Klingon to me.
Especially not in the Clockwork Orange way that we see Lorca become tortured in this episode.
Yeah, though I don't remember the name of the Klingon woman who's the captain of the ship in this episode, but she was wearing kind of the same white uniform that the Klingon woman in the last episode, who's Vokes. Lady friend.
Yes.
And so she had talked about being from, you know, this tribe of women, or this family of women that are very influential. And then this Klingon female here had talked about her family being spies. And so that's how she speaks such a good English. And so I've got to presume we're kind of introducing some sort of, you know, one of the Klingon families is a little bit more psychological in the way they approach war than maybe the rest of the Klingon families are. But that's, I don't know that that's necessarily anything they said. That's kind of me going, maybe that's it.
Lorca ends up finally meeting Lieutenant Tyler in the prison. And Lorca, you know, that his threat ganglia are up a little bit. And because he tells Tyler, hey, you've been here for 7 months. He's like, wow, I can't believe it's 7 months. And we find out that the captain has taken a liking to him. Are you buying this?
I see. And this is where I get suspicious of Tyler. I think Lorca puts that suspicion right out there. He's like, 7 months. This is baloney. And then when I saw Tyler, you know, try and offer Lorca his very special, like fancy Whole Foods cracker that he had smuggled away. Mm-hmm. That's when I was like, this seems a little too good to be true, that this guy is just here and he's so helpful and he's so committed to helping his captain. And so that's kind of what led me to be a little bit suspicious of him. The whole time he's kind of making sacrifices for the captain, which I think plays into Lorca's ego a little bit. And I think he'll probably be around for a while, but I'm definitely going to be suspicious of him until there's kind of the episode where you get into his head and he maybe has to make a choice between Starfleet or a potential deal he made with the Klingons. But yeah, I'm suspicious.
Here's why I'm suspicious, Jim. So Lieutenant Tyler has been on this Klingon vessel for 7 months now, but he's only got like, you know, this like perfectly groomed beard. Now, Harry Mudd, he looks like he's been in the Klingon prison for a while. Now, maybe it's possible the captain is sort of like keeping him as her boy toy and wants him groomed a particular way. But I can't imagine that the Klingon captain really wanted this specific beard look. I don't know. Something's off.
Yeah, I mean, wait, she's just like, you know, beat him up, but don't touch the face. I like the face. Like don't touch the face.
There was also this odd moment where the Klingon captain was torturing Captain Lorca, and he, like, throws it in her face. Like, so, I hear that you've been mingling with one of the human prisoners. That's beneath you. That he doesn't even have enough organs for you. And this seemed like that this was a little bit of a retcon in terms of the Klingon anatomy. Did you catch that?
I caught the line, and I did not bother to Google the amount of anatomy that Klingons have. I thought that might go poorly.
I feel like I would know if a Klingon female had that. This has never come up before.
No, I mean, I gotta presume that, like, Worf was just keeping it close to the vest, you know? Like, and they don't have, like, communal showers after, like, you know, Starfleet sports activities.
Right. I mean, are we to believe that a Klingon male has extra organs?
I that was the implication.
But that's not a thing.
Well, you know, it's one of the interesting things about the Klingons and this whole thing. And this is, you know, again, this is me kind of trying to, I'm so excited about, you know, new Star Trek. I feel like sometimes I'm like, okay, why would this be the case? Like, how can this work? And I'm constantly trying to, like, fix it, hoping that the show will eventually make it make sense. And I've got to presume that if sometime before the era of Captain Kirk, that there is like the Klingons use some sort of eugenics or some sort of, you know, disease changes how they look physically, that maybe it removed a penis.
Oh,
from their
maybe
anatomy.
That's why they're so mad.
Yeah. They're like, we used to have two of these dang things.
Yeah. This is just not something that is ever talked about. I don't know if this is canon.
There's some definite, I feel like Discovery has done this a few times with some shock and awe ways they put it out there. Like in the last episode where they talk about eating Captain Georgiou, mm-hmm. I feel like Klingons are constantly like, they're always talking about how savage Klingons are. And Klingons are like, I'll eat your brains. And, you know, like they kind of, but you're always take it a little bit as exaggeration or as the holdover of a more barbaric culture. And so I wonder if they're just like, well, this is the barbaric culture here. It was only 10 years before Kirk, but here it is.
Yeah. Now, Baylana Torres, I'm looking at the Memory Alpha wiki that she had a human father and a Klingon mother. So apparently, like, the biology will work.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not really, you know, the size that matters. It's how you use it. And obviously, you know,
well, forget size. About, we're talking about quantity over quality.
Well, and I suppose really in the future of Star Trek, you've got to presume that, you know, sexual aids have made some technological advances as well. You know, that's the leap I'll make for the show.
Yeah.
And, you know, like at the end of the day, if a Klingon female and a human male, like, if their hearts are really there, then I'm sure they can find a way to make it work.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we got to see that Harry Mudd has like a trained insect that's also with him. That's a little bit of like a circus mouse that can go and grab things. But the insect also, the bug was literally bugged. So could you just talk through, did the Klingons have Harry Mudd there on purpose? Like, was he actually a prisoner? And did Harry Mudd, Did Harry Mudd know that the Klingons had a bug on his bug?
Yeah, the way that it the way it seemed to me, and maybe we'll learn more about this with more Harry Mudd, but I think he was basically like, hey, I will help you learn information from these Starfleet guys if you spare me the pain, essentially. So I think he just made a deal. I think he's just self-motivated for his own self-preservation. And so he's happy to work with the Klingon as long as he doesn't, you know, end up beat up at the end of the day.
Okay. Did he end up befriending the bug on the Klingon ship?
I don't know. We'll have to have like a whole, extended universe novel explaining the backstory between Harry Mudd and Stuart the Bug.
Yeah, I feel like that could be a very nice children's story about Stuart the Bug.
Yeah. Han Solo gets Chewbacca, you know, a real badass. And Harry Mudd gets a, you know, adorable little Stuart the Bug.
Yeah, because I think that Tyler chucked Stuart the Bug against the wall at one point.
Yeah, it's the only time I feel like you see some legit like human emotion from Harry Mudd. He seems very broken up about, you know, some abuse to Stuart.
Yeah, don't hurt my bug. We're going to see Captain Lorca tortured. And boy, this light sensitivity is really a thing for him, where that's the extent of how the Klingons are torturing him, of that they're just going to shine a very bright light in his eyes.
This again seems not very Klingon, almost to the point. And like you're saying with the Cardassians, I could all I saw when I saw those lights were Picard going, there are four lights.
Yeah, I think there were three on the Klingon
ship.
Well,
there were three, yeah. Yeah, three here. But like there's just that classic moment. Yes. I was like, is this like a very subtle reference, you know, is this there for the fans or is it purely because he has light sensitivity? I couldn't tell, but I could not help but think of Picard. Yeah.
Yes. No, I thought the same thing. But yeah, that is how they were going to torture Captain Lorca here. And I mean, ultimately, we're going to work out this plan to escape the Klingon ship by way of the old choose your pain. What did you think about the escape from the Klingon ship?
I thought overall, you know, I think Discovery, with the action scenes, sometimes they feel a little shoehorned in. And I thought that overall they're fun, but I feel like they kind of mess with the pacing of the show a little bit. But in this one, I don't feel like it felt too out of place. And I thought it was pretty cool and fun overall. I like that we see, I guess, you know, Klingon phasers will vaporize people versus, yes, Starfleet phasers at this point, which is, you know, I don't want to. I'm trying not to get, as a fan, trying not to get too hung up on the technology, but seeing Klingons vaporize is pretty cool. So, you know, not too much to complain about, but I do think Tyler, like, losing it on the Klingon captain, that's the moment where I, at least for me, I was like, I feel like this is too much. I feel like maybe he's got maybe there's a PTSD thing going on or something like that, but it almost felt like he was selling the act a little bit. But maybe not. I don't know.
The thing is, though, that if this was some sort of like elaborate ruse, like there was a lot of Klingon loss of life in order to try to I don't know. Like maybe there's more than meets the eye with Tyler, but I can't imagine that this was like all part of a Klingon plot to ultimately make Lorca think that they just escaped. I mean, even the rescue where they beam them out, like the Klingons really played it very dangerously if they ultimately wanted Lorca to escape and vaporize his shuttlecraft, you know, a half a second after he beamed out of there.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to presume that would be, you know, they sell it, they really sell it, or they don't worry about it. And I think that's, at the end of the day, if it does turn out to be a plot, I think that's one of the things on a rewatch you'd look back and you'd be like, it's really lucky that they made it off, mm-hmm, this ship. But at the same point, you know, maybe that's what it was at the end of the day. I don't know. We'll see. I'm curious. But at the end of the day, the action was pretty fun. It's pretty good. And you gotta imagine, too, a little sacrificing of a Klingon life. As long as they die a noble death in battle, they're going to end up in Stovacor. So,
yeah, I also like how the Klingon rifle also, you know, it not only shoots, but also has, it's like a musket. It has like a spear on the end.
Klingons are obsessed with their knives in phaser fights. They love them.
Yeah.
Can't live without them.
All right. Meanwhile, back on Discovery, we're going to see a lot of testing going on. And I was surprised that Stamets ultimately ends up being somebody who was convinced about the condition of the tardigrade, because that he did not really seem like he was super interested in, like, he was more interested in the science of it. And then that was sort of like a workaround to put the tardigrade in there. But then he was on board report. He ends up getting convinced pretty quickly by Michael Burnham that there was something wrong with the tardigrade.
Yeah, and I love this. It was one of the things I feel like so far Discovery has been a very action-oriented show, and it has had, you know, I think the last episode we got a little bit more into it with the tardigrade, but like the kind of high-concept sci-fi and the moralistic nature of like the tales that sci-fi can be used to tell, which Star Trek is very famous for, have not come out in the show very much. And I thought Stamets, as a scientist who is results driven, but is also, unlike Lorca, he's not military. He's not, the war is not his only concern, and the quality of his science is part of his concern. And so therefore he has a little bit more of the moral guidelines of Burnham and Dr. Culber, which is hurting a creature to achieve my ends is not a worthy use of that. And I love that they got into that. And I love that Stamets, at the end of the day, while he absolutely wants the science to go forward, it is very Starfleet, it is very Star Trek to have him basically be like, yeah, but not the wrong way. I want to win this the right way. And I like that.
So there was this idea of, could they ultimately get the ship to navigate and make these jumps without the use of the tardigrade? And there was some talk of a software solution, and maybe could there be another life form that ultimately gets injected with this tardigrade DNA? And as they're talking this through, this was a bit of a blindside to me that we end up getting a couple of F-bombs dropped in this scene about how cool all of this is. Jim, did that take you out of Star Trek Discovery at any point?
You know what? Tilly's initial F-bomb did, and I just felt like it was CBS like winking at the audience, like, well, you know, we're on All Access now. Wink, wink, we can swear. But as soon as Stamets kind of like very genuinely...
Yes, this is effing cool.
Yeah, I was like, that was the moment where I was like, oh, this seemed like a gimmick until that moment. And it's still a little gimmicky, but they won me over with like the way Stamets kind of reacted. And then even Burnham, they show like a quick shot of her like smiling because she's kind of, you know, into this moment. Yes. That's when I was like, this is actually, you know, it did take me out for a second, but I actually thought it was some pretty fun character building. In a way, I would have never expected Star Trek to like win me over, but I did like this a lot.
Yes, maybe aboard Federation and Starfleet ships, it's just very untoward to use the F word. You have to put like a credit into the swear jar if you do that. But at this point in the history of the Federation, people were still using those words.
It's still, I mean, if we can have a gritty reboot of Harry Mudd, then hey, man, Starfleet is using, they're dropping knowledge and F-bombs left and right.
Yeah. And so Saru wants to make a jump, and then he gets the word that Stamets has shut down the spore drive, and he is not pleased to hear that. You would think that Stamets would give a heads up to the captain that the spore drive is offline.
Yeah, though Stamets seems to give zero cares to like the thoughts of any captain. Mm-hmm. But I think it goes to, and I think this is where this is a great episode for Saru, is you see Saru in a new type of position of power that he hasn't been in before. You know, he's either had the backing of Lorca behind him in the past, and Lorca is essentially a bit feared with him among his crew. And you have Saru now having to instill that same loyalty and have his crew act out his orders. And I liked that we saw Saru struggle with this. And I like that that becomes the whole arc with him and Burnham and talking about Captain Georgiou. It was a really good episode for his character, I think.
Yeah. And he ends up storming down to engineering and saying, that's it. I told you I didn't want to hear about the tardigrade. And Michael Burnham tries to reason with him like, no, it's just your culture that's making you do this. And I feel like that was a bad move for Michael Burnham to say that, where it's like when I try to say to my wife, like, you know, I could tell when my wife has not gotten enough sleep, and I'm like, no, you're just getting mad at me because you're cranky. Like, this is not the right approach here. You should not tell somebody that the reason why they're doing this is because X. People don't like to hear that.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of like one of those moments where I kind of feel my, like, Burnham, it's all of your main characters into one theory comes together, is because mm-hmm. I feel like when she taps into her human side, she can really connect with people. And at the end of the episode, she really connects with Saru by kind of putting logic aside for a second and focusing on her human side. But you see that the times, even though she's incredibly smart, the times she most offends and upsets people and gets herself into trouble is when she kind of puts logic first. And I think for her, her arc on the show, I think, is going to be balancing that, you know, and in a way that like Spock was always kind of balancing his Vulcan but human nature. I think she's going to have to balance that as well. I think we're seeing that now. And every time she goes the wrong way, Sarah's just like, oh, my God, you're the worst, Burnham. You're confined to quarters.
Yeah. Michael Burnham gets grounded a lot on this show where it's like, Michael Burnham, go to your room. That's it. We don't want to see you just, the rest of the day.
It's like she like was a high school kid who had like one taste of alcohol. And now she's like, I'm a rebel now. Mm-hmm. I'm just always rebelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a mutineer. And she has to go to her room. And then she's basically out of the action the rest of the episode. I mean, we'll see her then at the very end of the episode. But then basically she does not play a part in the rescue.
Yeah. And I like this in the sense that I feel like a lot of Trek, you'll sideline the captain or your lead to tell more of a story about some side characters. And I thought Burnham played her role to inform Saru in this episode, which I thought was good.
And so they end up hooking up the tardigrade. They make the jump. But then after that, the tardigrade ends up literally just curling up into a ball and then evacuating all of the water from it. And it's very hard to get a life sign from the tardigrade. And now everybody is getting cold feet about trying to do anything with the tardigrade.
Yeah, except Saru, who I think is very Lorca motivated at this point, and he's like, I don't care, you get that tardigrade rolling, or you
right
know,
what
we're
would Captain Pike do in this situation?
Right. And I think the interesting thing is, and initially when I was watching the scene, I was like, what an oversight on Saru's part that he makes this jump knowing that they might deplete the tardigrade at any moment, and he had no escape plan. But at the end of, you know, once you get to the end of the episode and you see him basically being like, I think I screwed up. It made perfect sense. Like the pressure of being captain and him not having kind of the leadership he needed to get to that point, which he, I think, clearly feels he has not gotten from Lorca. It all made sense to me. And I thought, I was like, oh, this is the mistake he made. This is one of the mistakes he made. And I, you know, I don't know. I liked it. I thought Saru went from kind of like the token alien on board the ship to being like a very real character in this episode.
And you know what? I don't think that Saru screwed up at all. I mean, I felt like that Dr. Culber got a little precious with Saru and being like, hey, I will not be a party to murder. It's like, well, if the captain dies because you didn't want to hurt the tardigrade, I feel like that's not a great look.
Well, and even more so if the whole crew dies because we don't, you know, because we're in Klingon territory now, and it's because you didn't want to do something that's kind of like morally wrong in hurting this creature. And I think that's the thing. Saru had to make that tough choice as a captain. And I think he made the right choice at the end of the day. But I think that's kind of that one of those classic Star Trek narratives where it's like, is it the good of the many or the good of the one? And if we
if the one is a tardigrade?
Well, I think that's the thing. It becomes that, you know, this idea of it shouldn't just be about a human's life. It should be about any life. It should be about any sentience. And I think all of this was really like, it's the most Star Trek, I think, Discovery has felt so far. And I really like that about this episode.
Mm-hmm. The thing that I didn't quite understand was that if the Discovery can make a short leap without the tardigrade, the problem is that they cannot make a long leap to anywhere right without the tardigrade. I didn't understand why they couldn't just make a short leap to get out of that hot spot and then hit the warp drive and then just get out of there.
Yeah, or even warp until they run into a Klingon ship, then make a short jump. Yeah, I think there's some other solutions, but you know, that probably doesn't make the crucible of Saru's time as captain as compelling.
Mm-hmm.
If he comes up with like a nice middle ground solution.
Ultimately, they are able to track down the shuttlecraft, and Saru is the one who's able to determine that the shuttlecraft has the captain on board. I have to say, while the effects have been pretty amazing all the way through, I thought that the shuttlecraft scene were some of the worst effects we've seen on the show.
Yeah, I was not particularly wowed by it. I was also really taken out of it by the fact that the Klingon Raiders look very odd up close. They almost look like they reminded me of like the gun submarines from the Phantom Menace, which is not really a good sign. But yeah, they're just, I was just kind of like, why do their ships have like a peacock tail on the back of them?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I guess it's action for action's sake. It didn't super wow me, but you know, I think thankfully there was enough compelling character stuff in this episode that I was like, I'll let this pass.
Right. So they opened up a hailing frequency. They find out that it's Lorca. I mean, Lorca really was taking his sweet time here. I mean, we talked about what a close call it was, but he's like, how about that? Can you believe that's my ship? That he's just like, get us out of here. Get us out of this clear. They're going to blow up the ship.
Lorca, he's cool under pressure. He's cool under pressure. He's like, as long as it's not hurting my eyes, I can deal with anything.
Yeah, I can deal with anything. I didn't like also that they beamed them out of the shuttlecraft, and they were very clearly like sitting down in the shuttlecraft, but then when they beamed on board the Discovery, they were standing up.
I mean, maybe that's just how good Lorca is.
Yes. You
know? Yeah. He changes all of his internal matter in mid-transport.
Yeah, he stiffened up and said, okay, I got to be standing up. I'll look so stupid if I just fall down. Unlike Tyler, who did fall down when he got onto the shuttle pad. But then they ended up going and making the leap, and Stamets hooked himself into the ship's computer to be able to inject himself with the tardigrade DNA. But at what cost? We will find out later on in the episode. Why was he that was like the things hooked into him in his sides? Is that why he was bleeding from his sides?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was presumably not enough time to adapt the machine to, like, you know, be like a helmet he puts on or something.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it has to interact with his DNA, maybe.
Right.
But yeah, I presume, you know, that was the risk he took. But I got to say, this scene was like the moment where I think I kind of fell in love with Discovery for the first time, because, you know, I as a Star Trek fan, you must relate, Rob. Like, you really have a affection for the crews when you watch these shows for a long time. And while Discovery has had some compelling characters, I had not felt that yet. And Stamets' just hysterical laughter at like doing science was the moment where I was like, oh, this is so great.
I'm surprised, though, that Michael Burnham wasn't pitched, at least by Stamets, as somebody willing to make this sacrifice. I mean, I feel like that she would have been a real contender for a person like she already is beating herself up. She already has this martyr thing as being the mutineer. I kind of feel like if Stamets would have approached her with this idea, she would have jumped at this chance.
Probably. But I do think what we get, you know, in the to jump ahead a smidge in the final scene with Stamets and Dr. Culber in their quarters, where Culber is like, why would you do something so foolish? And he's like, I did it to save the captain. And then he's like, Culber's like, that's BS. And then he's like, I did it to save you. Mm-hmm. I did it to save the crew. I did, you know, it becomes that thing where I think, you know, and I think he also says to Culber, like, I did it because if I hurt the tardigrade anymore,
you'd be mad at me.
Yeah, and it would have changed who I am in your eyes as this mad scientist who's maybe gone too mad. And I like the idea that, like, at the end of the day, he put his money where his mouth is, and he realized that, you know, as much as he cares about science, he cares about this relationship of his. He cares about doing things the right way. And I feel like that all was that really, like, this is what Starfleet is about. Starfleet is about making the right choices, even if they're hard. And I thought that was great.
Okay, we'll come back to Stamets because we have to talk about that last scene. But Michael Burnham is going to have one more scene with Saru, and she is going to basically get back on the same page that he was jealous of Michael Burnham, that she didn't ultimately leave and get her own command. He wanted to stand by Captain Georgiou and absorb everything that she had to learn. And this is where Michael Burnham says, I will give you her telescope so you can see the world how she sees it, or see the universe how she saw it through this telescope that nobody can explain how the telescope got off of the Shenzhou.
Do you think, Rob, do you think Saru is just not familiar with the human concept of regifting, so he wasn't offended by this?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's like she got this one episode ago, and then she was like, yeah, Saru, I've got this thing cluttering up the space under my bed.
She didn't even take it out of the case. She's like, stupid telescope. Put it under the bed.
Yeah, I thought it was a little goofy that maybe the function of the telescope last episode was simply to kind of get Saru and Michael Burnham back on the same page in this episode. Mm-hmm. But what I did really like about this scene is Saru is like very human and very vulnerable in this scene. And he's straightforward. He's kind of petty. Like his reason for being mad at Burnham is in many ways a personal reason. It's because he missed out on his opportunity to be George's first officer. And that's kind of where his anger come from. And I like that Burnham kind of relates to him and shows her human side here. So I thought the regifting of the telescope was a little goofy, but I think we may have like turned the corner on the Saru Burnham relationship, because I got to presume that at some point in the show, that's your captain and first officer on the show, Burnham as captain and Saru as the first officer.
Interesting. You think that we could just be one and done with Lorca, or he goes off and, you know, ends up becoming like a villain in some way?
Well, my overall theory, and it will depend, I guess, it depends on how long the show actually stays with the Klingon War, because I think what they're trying to do with Lorca is something they kind of bring up in a few episodes of Star Trek here and there. Like, I remember most recently I was rewatching the two Deep Space Nine episodes where they go back to Earth and Admiral tries to basically like do a scare that there's like sleeper agents on Earth so he can gain martial law control of the planet Earth. Mm-hmm. And it's like this idea that Star Trek or Starfleet was militarized, and there are elements of Starfleet that are not explorers and they're not diplomats. They're soldiers, and they feel hamstrung by Starfleet's, you know, rules. And so I think Lorca is kind of here to show that he's the epitomization of Starfleet's military aspect. And maybe he's, you know, I thought maybe the tardigrade would go on a whole season and it would be like him enslaving a whole race of tardigrades to win this war. And that becomes this, you know, crisis of conscience for all of Starfleet, and they change their act. But I think at the end of the day, Lorca is here to show us that Starfleet could be all about doing whatever you need to do to make it work. When I feel like Starfleet really, as we know them as Star Trek fans, is Starfleet will not, there's certain boundaries Starfleet won't cross. And it's more important to not, you know, to save your soul and to not cross those boundaries. And I think that's what we're going to get with Lorca versus kind of Burnham and Saru.
Now, interestingly, Saru ends up assigning Michael Burnham, go save the tardigrade's life. Okay, that makes sense to me. You know, we found out, okay, well, this thing may have some intelligence, and so it's very important. I mean, we saw the Admiral on the starbase saying, like, hey, we need to find more tardigrades. This is very important, the tardigrade. And so Michael Burnham, in all of her infinite wisdom, decides, okay, I'm going to set the tardigrade free. You would have to think that the mutineer Michael Burnham, who's already on shaky ground, this did not seem like the best move to me.
No, and I can only imagine that this is going to lead to a scene since next episode where Lorca is just flinging the bowl of fortune cookies right off his desk.
And Cadet Tilly, I don't know what you're thinking here. That this is not the best career move for you.
No, but I do, you know, I think this is where I kind of look at it as like, I feel like this is where we see the heart and soul of Starfleet doing the right thing, and Lorca will do anything to win. And I think this is going to be a major part of that conflict, because you have Saru, you have Burnham, and you have Cadet Tilly, and in ways, you know, probably Culber and Stamets who will back them up. And so you have the makings of maybe a mutiny or some sort of big conflict on the ship. But yeah, I mean, I think it was I liked this scene. I found more touching than I would have expected. And it reminded me of, I think it's the TNG pilot where there's that like abused cosmic jellyfish underneath
Farpoint Station. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love the weird, like there's just a big weird living thing in space. Like that's one of those Star Trek things that I think a lot of like hardcore Star Trek fans like think is dumb.
Like the crystalline entity.
Yeah, I've always found it really like fascinating. And I love the idea that they're like, oh, wait, you know, science, since they wrote Star Trek years ago, actually has found a creature that can live in a vacuum, and presumably a tardigrade could live in space. And so let's do that. So I had like, you know, moments of, you know, callback moments to that TNG episode. But yeah, I don't know. I think this is going to be like a huge issue going forward because they basically just gave away the secret to the defeating the Klingons.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because Lorca, if you recall, originally brought it on the ship to say that thing's a killing machine. We got to figure out how to study it. How does it kill all these people? What is it made out of? So before they even knew it was the secret to unlocking the spore drive.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because I was thinking about this. I was like, the spore drive has become really important on this show. And finding the tardigrade was, in essence, an accident. Like, Lorca beams it over so they can use its hide as some sort of weapon, and Burnham puts it together. And you've got to presume that Burnham, who I think, and you guys have talked about this a little bit, I think her being blamed for the whole Klingon war is like a little suspect like how they're making that logic work for apparently all of Starfleet believes that. Or most of Starfleet believes that. But you got to presume that, like, Burnham is going to have a harder time living with herself if she, you know, as a mutineer, she can be like kind of a noble, like, I screwed up and I'll spend the rest of my days in prison and leave me alone. But if she helps enslave potentially an entire race of creatures, sentient creatures, that's some dark. That's some really dark
stuff.
What
if we win the war?
Yeah, I mean, but that's where I think like this show is probably in many ways about the heart and soul of humanity and Starfleet, and how far is too far in science, and how far is too far for the sake of power or winning a war. And I think Lorca is the guy. He will not stop. And then you thankfully have some, you know, caring and compassionate Starfleet members who are like, yeah, but the tardigrade, he's kind of cuddly. Like, let's not enslave his whole race.
Yeah. All right. Now, in the final scene of the episode, first off, we get a big reveal that Stamets and Dr. Culber are a couple. And boy, this is exciting.
It is. I would say I loved this scene of them brushing their teeth in their quarters. I thought it was really, really good. But the only thing that kind of grinded me a little bit about it that I didn't like is
matching pajamas.
No, the matching pajamas were adorable, Rob. I loved them. but I thought it was a little, I felt like they played like, Stamets and Culber are in a relationship together. I felt like they played it a little bit like the reveal that there's a homosexual relationship on a Star Trek show was like a shocking thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a little bit of that vibe. Like, the scene in and of itself is great and it's very cute and their banter together is really good and it's a really good character building scene for both of them. I just felt like they played it a little bit as novelty initially. And I was like, that seems a little off. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it, I think, made up for it. It was really good otherwise. And the end of the scene is chilling.
Yeah. What is going on there? And in case anybody missed it, we saw Stamets walk away, yet his reflection stayed in the mirror for a few moments and then sort of like smiled and then walked into the other room. What is going on here? Is this some result of being injected with the tardigrade DNA? Is this a sign of something else to come? Perhaps now the Star Trek mirror universe, like, it doesn't literally live in the mirror. It's not like Alice in Wonderland type thing. Do you have a theory?
Oh, man, I certainly hope they don't go back to more Michael Burnham doing Through the Looking Glass.
Oh, no. That tied it all together.
I hope we can just drop that aspect of. But no, I think I watched this twice out of curiosity because I couldn't quite tell if Stamets. It's like a reflection doing the exact same thing.
I watched
it
twice, too. I went back. And let me just say that the with all due respect to our friends over at CBS.com, this was it was very clunky to go back and try to rewatch like the last part of an episode and not go directly into after Trek. It took me like 10 minutes to get back to this.
But yeah, I mean, I could not tell if he was doing the exact same thing or a slightly different thing, or his reflection was doing a slightly different thing. And so I don't know. I thought the very interesting thing that's not even in the episode is this episode was not followed up by like a sizzle reel for the next episode. And so it's even more unsettling that there's like, you see this very creepy moment that I literally got chills and I was, you know, like, that's just cool. Like, that doesn't happen every time you watch an episode of TV. And I was literally like, oh, that was scary. And then no next time on Discovery is like, wow, anything could happen with this. I like that they're playing it close to the vest with that.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like we have so much on our plate here with the Discovery, with Lorca, with the Klingon War. I mean, to add in this idea of like this parallel mirror world, that I mean, this is I have no idea where this is going.
Well, so I think it's going to tie back into the, I forget exactly what they called it, but essentially the subspace network that all the mushrooms and the tardigrade tap into. Because part of the thing that I think is, it's been interesting watching the show, because the serialization is very much a one thing leads to the next thing. One thing leads to the next thing. It's not necessarily this whole arc is a novel and you might get information in episode 2 that you don't see again until episode 10. It's very much like whatever happened in episode 5 will lead to something in episode 6. So far is the trend we've seen. And so I've got to presume, you know, we kind of, you know, we meet the tardigrade, then we find out the tardigrade is connected to the spore drive. Then we find out that the spore drive hurts the tardigrade, and then it becomes, OK, how do we use it? Oh, humans can connect to the spore drive, but it might be dangerous. And now I think we're going to see why it's even more dangerous. And my theory beyond this is that I think this will probably lead to Starfleet realizing they cannot tap into the spore drive, which will in continuity explain why we have never seen the spore drive in future episodes of Star Trek.
Spore drive is dangerous.
Spore drive is dangerous, so much so that it leads to, yeah, potentially like separate versions of people's selves wandering around the ship, presumably going evil and growing goatees.
Mirror Stamets, and what is that going to look like?
He'll be just as salty as he always is.
Yeah.
Oh. that character trait, I don't think any Mirror Universe version could get rid of.
Maybe you could only see Mirror Stamets through Georgia's telescope.
Oh.
But you have to look at it backwards. You have to look.
Sarah's just walking around the halls with a giant telescope, and Burnham's got a phaser alongside of him.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like a cooperative video game right there.
Yeah. Oh.
But I don't know. I think ending with this on Stamets had such a good episode. Like he was a fun character already, but I think he became like a three-dimensional character in this show. And so to see him kind of to the cliffhanger be this very creepy cliffhanger, and I thought well executed, it also was like, oh, this is a character that I now, after this episode, really care about. And I know he's got a relationship and all this stuff. And so it's kind of a nice person to potentially put into jeopardy to get me very excited about the next episode.
Jim, this was very fun to go through everything with you, and that you really know your stuff with everything Discovery so far.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. This was a blast. I've been enjoying listening to the podcast just, you know, as I've been, I cannot get enough of Star Trek right now. And so it was an absolute pleasure to be able to just nerd out publicly with you on this.
Yeah. And you make a very compelling case that this is the episode of Discovery, I do think, that is infused the most with sort of the soul of what is Star Trek.
Yeah, I think if this is, you know, kind of, and I get it, and I think this has been said in a few previous podcasts, but Star Trek series always take a little bit to get going. And so, you know, and in the past, you know, sometimes that's like a season or two. And I think, you know, the pilot was definitely action oriented.
We're ahead of schedule.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and we are, and I think, you know, we have increased the quality of episodes pretty significantly episode by episode. And I don't think we started in a terrible place. So I am very optimistic about Discovery now after this episode.
Okay. All right. Well, Jim, great job. If you want to follow Jim on Twitter, he is at the Jim Gibbons. And you can see everything that Jim is tweeting about. And if you want to listen to more of Jim, you could listen to Jim on the Marvel Defenders podcast, although maybe didn't love it as much as Star Trek Discovery.
No, so far, if you want to hear the two sides of my personality, you can listen to this podcast.
The Mirror Jim.
Yeah, Mirror Jim is all.
Did you hook yourself up to a spore drive before you did this podcast?
I don't like to talk about my personal spore drive time, Rob. That's between me and my spore drive.
You got it. Those Federation toothbrushes looked pretty nifty also.
Yeah, I would have thought we, you know, at this point in the future, we'd just be like flashing UV, like some sort of UV light into our mouth to clean it.
No, still needs 2 minutes.
It's nice to know that some things remain the same.
They
no
were
matter
so
where
quiet.
We
that's, I think, the appeal.
That's how you can have like a nice intimate conversation in your bathroom.
Yeah. Well, it really speaks to that maybe what the Klingon captain might have in her bedside drawer as well with getting Tyler as well.
Maybe.
That technology.
Maybe. That technology has really improved. That's what we've learned. Much quieter. Well,
it really made an impression on Tyler, who just mercilessly just beat her when he had the opportunity to get away.
Yeah.
He did not enjoy his time.
No, I think that's the next big thing. Whether he's a sleeper agent or whether he's just going through some really bad stuff from being on that Klingon ship for so long. I think Tyler and Mirror Stamets are going to be our next episode, and will take us, through the next bit of the series.
Okay. All right. Well, to make sure you don't miss any of our Star Trek Discovery coverage, that podcast link is postshowrecaps.com/Star Trek. So very eager to see how the rest of this season is going to play out. Of course, plenty of other stuff going up on Post Show Recaps, the Fear the Walking Dead season 3 finale. And boy, that was a show. Let me just say, the 2-hour finale of Fear the Walking Dead season 3. That was boy, nobody is ready for what went on in those 2 hours. My Game of Thrones rewatch with Josh Wigler. Of course, Josh Wigler and Antonio Mazzaro have all of the Mr. Robot coverage going on, all on postshowrecaps.com. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say in the comments. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.